What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. He is the undisputed king of Sunday morning Washington talk. Since taking the helm at NBC's Meet the Press in 1991, Tim Russert has become a luminous pole star in Washington journalism. He gets the big get, the big interviews, going one-on-one with President Bush in the Oval Office, questioning Vice President Dick Cheney on Iraq war planning, probing senators and congressmen with hard-nosed questions, making presidential candidates squirm. But when you ask Tim Russert about the source of his success these days, he doesn't talk about his own talent at going toe-to-toe with the toughest players in Washington's rough-and-tumble political scene. Tim Russert looks back to his hometown, Buffalo, New York, to the man he calls Big Russ, his father. Hardly a day goes by when I don't remember or rely on something that Big Russ taught me, Russert writes in his new book, Big Russ and Me. And those lessons, be yourself, don't get fancy, don't talk that Washington talk, ask questions the people back in Buffalo would ask, have propelled Tim Russert to the very top of his game. Tonight on Point, meet the press host, Tim Russert, on the war, on Washington, on a father and his son. Tim Russert joins me now from Washington. His new book is Big Russ and Me, Father and Son, Lessons of Life. Good evening and welcome, Tim Russert.
Great to be here.
Tim, great to have you. A lot to talk about from your life and your work. A lot of Americans pay a lot of attention, so do a lot of very powerful Americans in Washington. We want to hear about your father tonight and that relationship and Buffalo, where we have a lot of listeners. But I wish you'd just take us first to this crazy incident last weekend when you were taping, talking with Colin Powell, who was sitting by the Dead Sea, and suddenly the camera just panned away into the palm trees and the whipping wind over the sea. What happened there, Tim?
Well, the way we have recreated it is that his producer on site said to our producer in the control room, okay, time to wrap. And so they say that in my earpiece. And so I said, finally, Mr. Secretary, and I began to ask my last question. Suddenly the camera lurched off of Secretary Powell to a palm tree in the ocean, as you described it.
Right.
And I didn't know what had happened. I didn't know if he had been hurt or there was some kind of scene or episode, and God forbid. And then I heard an exchange between Secretary Powell and someone who was clearly his assistant, and he said, he's still asking me a question. Put the camera back on me. And then the famous, get out of the way.
Emily, get out of the way. Right.
And I knew who that was. And so what it clearly was is an overzealous press aide who decided that she was going to take it in her own hands to interrupt and end the interview, even though we were already in the last question. He called me, the secretary called me and said, you know, it was not in any way an attempt of editorial censorship. It was simply a matter of time. And everyone learned their lesson from it, and time to move on. That's fine by me.
But at the moment and in the aftermath, you were pretty steamed.
Well, I was concerned, one, that something awful had happened. And then when I realized it was simply a press aide who was paid for by the U.S. taxpayers cutting off an interview between an American journalist and an American Secretary of State, I said, this is not appropriate.
And 13 years in the business, and I've never seen anything like this, or that worse to that effect.
Never happened, yeah. And credit to Secretary Powell. He was is a general, and he took charge. He said, Emily, I'm basically overruling you.
Right. Move
the camera back and go sit down and let me finish the interview, which he did, and I thank him for it.
Tim Russert, at this point in your career, an incident like that does not happen very often. You are described up and down the line as the guy at the top of the Washington press mountain, certainly the Sunday morning Washington talk mountain right now, huge influence. Everybody is happy to come on and talk and prove their chops with Tim Russert. How do you define your role in the American press, the Washington press corps right now? Look at it as a Martian might. What function does Tim Russert play in the American public's interaction with the great and powerful?
Well, first, some people won't come on any given week. We've been trying to get Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld to come on for the last several weeks.
Not good weeks for him. He may be ducking.
He has respectfully declined. So eventually they come, but sometimes not the week you want them or invite them. Meet the Press is the longest-running television program in the world. It started 57 years ago by Lawrence Spivak and Martha Rountree, originally a radio program, and then became television in 1947. I had a chance to talk to Mr. Spivak before he died some 12 years ago, and he told me some wonderful advice. He said, learn as much as you can about your guest and his and her position on the issues, and take the other side, and be persistent, but be civil. And that's what I try to do. And I hope by my preparation and trying to challenge guests, they understand they'll have an opportunity to finish their thoughts and finish their sentences. But I'll also be prepared so I can engage in a substantive conversation, and it just won't be one of political spin or prefab answers. And so if that resonates with the people of Washington or the people of America, I'm very, very happy. It's this way I approach my job.
And what do you think of as your job, your burden, your role, the thing that you need to accomplish with these interviews? How do you think of it in your own mind, Tim?
Well, my dad gives me pretty good advice. He said, pretend you're talking to me. And he's right. So often I watch Washington-based interviews and they get caught up in hyperbole or a parlance or a language that is so foreign to the rest of the country. So my job is to try to elicit from our nation's leaders or world leaders what they really have in mind for us. If President Bush is on, I asked him whether Iraq was a war of choice or necessity, which I think is a very fundamental question. With Senator Kerry, what he would do differently than George Bush. And I try to get a specific answer as possible. Every politician wants to tell you they're going to preserve and protect Social Security. Every politician wants to say that we're going to stay the course or we can't cut and run in Iraq. And I try to get behind that soundbite and find out what they really intend if they know, which is also sometimes the case.
Tim Russert, how did you get into this business? It's an interesting trail.
Well, in seventh grade, it was actually Sister Mary Lucille who summoned me to the front of the class and said, Timothy, we need a vehicle to channel your excessive energy. I had been spending much more time throwing paper clips and spitballs and snowballs than I was focusing on my work. So she started the school newspaper and made me the editor, and it changed my life. And it got me to go to Canisius Jesuit High School, where the first day I walked in the class and the teacher said, sit down, take a piece of paper out, and describe what you saw coming to school today. I said, where's the true-false? Where's the multiple choice? And you're making me think. And it really did alter the way I approach the world. I now walk into a room very much aware where I am, who's there, who's talking, saying what. And then I went to college, took a year off, taught school, went to law school. And after law school, I took the New York State bar exam in July. And then you're in limbo until December, where you find out whether you're passed or not. So I volunteered on the campaign of one Daniel Patrick Moynihan and worked with him in the Senate, where I met a gentleman named Leonard Garment, who had been counsel to President Nixon, who knew Larry Grossman, former president of PBS, who became president of NBC News. And I had dinner with him, and I joined NBC News as an executive behind the scenes.
On the business side.
Yeah, in 1984, in charge of the Today Show, and traveled the Today Show around the world, and did that for about 4 years, went to the Washington Bureau. There was a new news president by then by the name of Michael Gartner, who listened to my analysis on the telephone during conference calls with show producers, and he said, you should be on TV. And that was in 1991.
Were you, when you were on the business side, were you hungering to be in front of the camera? Did it look like that was where the action was? That's where you could make an impact? That's where you could make the money? What was your attitude before you got on that side of the camera about that kind of work, that job?
Well, I thought that the correspondents and the producers were people who were enjoying their work day in and day out and were challenged by it, invigorated by it. But I never saw myself in that capacity. I don't look like I belong on TV. Most people on TV had these rugged jaws, and I have cheeks. And I had never – many people come from local broadcasting careers. I had never had done any of that. And I thought that if I could contribute anything, it would be because of my background and experience. And I hoped insights into the political process and political behavior. I didn't know if it would work or not. And so I thought long and hard about it when Michael Gartner asked me to take on Meet the Press. I thought I would try. I thought I'd be do it by being myself, and it didn't work, so be it. No one really knew who I was, anyhow. Mm-hmm. And that was 13 years later.
At this point, many people are describing Tim Russert as often bigger than his guests, in that you are there every Sunday morning with the megaphone, and not only there, but in your various other roles and appearances around the dial. How has your role changed over those years, and what do you make of the Tim Russert's bigger than his guests characterization?
Yeah, I guess I don't accept that. I think my role is very much secondary. There are lots of places on the TV dial that you can turn to where people are going to tell you what they think and what their opinion is and whether the war is good or bad or whether tax cuts are good or bad, and I just don't do that. My job is to stay objective and ask questions, take the other side, the Socratic method, if you will, try to draw people out. On the Today Show, my analysis is not my own opinion. It's reporting, and I'll say this is the Democratic view, the Republican view, the Bush view, the Kerry view. You just do your job, and you do it as much as you can, as well as you can. And I hope there's an expectation that if people come on Meet the Press that they have to be prepared. If they do well, it can resonate with the political media community and the country. We have 5 or 6 million viewers. And if you don't do well, it's an indication that you haven't really mastered the issues or you're not particularly articulate in one way or the other on something that is of concern to the American people. I'm the constant because I'm the moderator. There's only been 8 in 57 years. Mm-hmm. But it's the guest who really does set the trend, the pace, the rhythm of the show.
You've been in that chair now through 4 administrations, I guess, if you count the 2 Clintons as 2. Bush 1, Clinton, 2 terms, and now Bush 2. George W. Bush's administration is often characterized by a lot of your pals, your colleagues anyway, there in Washington, as among the most secretive in modern American history. Do you find that borne out in your interviews with officials of this administration, high, medium, low?
I've never had any problem getting access with any of the administrations you talked about. I work very hard to make phone calls and to get them returned and report. And so, too, with getting guests to come on Meet the Press. I do think that the Bush administration in the foreign policy area had a sense of certitude about a lot of things that was a little bit different than the Clinton administration. And I went back and actually reread all of the interviews I had with Vice President Cheney and Secretary Rumsfeld, Secretary Powell, and National Security Advisor Rice over the last year and a half, and it's really quite revealing. A couple of days before the war in March of 2003, Vice President Cheney said, "We will be greeted as liberators." And I said, "But what if we're not? Mm-hmm. What if, in fact, it's a long and protracted and bloody resistance? What happens then?" And he said, "That's not the case, Tim. We will be greeted as liberators." And that clearly was the mindset. And it's an extraordinary history lesson when you go back and just find the mindset of the Bush administration vis-a-vis Iraq a year and a half ago. So they came on, they talked, they set the record straight, and now it's there for all of us to revisit.
And everybody can see what's happening today. So you've got the access, but on the candor front, do you see candor equivalent to what you saw from President Bush's father's officials, from Bill Clinton's officials?
I just finished this book, as you mentioned, Big Russ and Me, mm-hmm. Father and Son, Lessons of Life. People always ask me, why did I write a political book? My guess is if I did, the title would be They're All Alike. I find that Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives who run for office try to present things in the most favorable light for their own situation and circumstance. And the viewer or the listener sees things through their own ideological prism. If they're a Republican, they think that George Bush is candid. If they're a Democrat, they think he's stonewalling. And it's and same with John Kerry. So I have not found any great difference in the administrations I've covered, whether they're Democrat or Republican.
Just right up the middle. We're talking tonight with Tim Russert, host of NBC's Meet the Press, author of the new book, Big Russ and Me, Father and Son, Lessons of Life. Big Russ, his father, Tim Russert, same name, who handed him a lot of phrases to live by. What a country. You got to eat. You do everything you can. And then just a little more, Tim Russert, who came up in Buffalo. We'll talk about that through Catholic schools. We'll talk about that, now described as often bigger than his guests. And his guests are pretty darn big. We had to speak with Tim Russert earlier today, so we can't get your questions on air tonight. Bear with us on that. But we will hear a lot from the host of Meet the Press. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with host of NBC's Meet the Press, Tim Russert. He's out with a new book, Big Russ and Me, Father and Son, Lessons of Life. Tim Russert, the Go Bills cry often comes out of your studio, a big fan of the Buffalo teams and of Buffalo, even now when you're not a kid anymore. Describe the Buffalo you grew up in and what of it has stuck with you and why.
Well, Buffalo, to me, is much more than a geographic location. It's a way of life. It's a cultural phenomenon in many ways. It was a Irish Catholic neighborhood where people really knew each other, looked out for each other, understood each other, where people like my dad, who were born during the Depression and then left school in the 10th grade to fight in World War II, he was badly injured in a plane accident and spent 6 months in a hospital, then came home and took on two full-time jobs as a garbage man and truck driver. It was not unusual for the men in the neighborhood to work two jobs. Their mission was to provide and educate their kids. We had four kids in our family. And we didn't have planned play dates. We came home from school and the neighborhood streets were teeming with kids, always someone to play with, pick up games, whatever. Then we retire home and sit at the kitchen table and do our homework, and where my mom was very much a central force in our lives, and she had one rule that when we couldn't trade our pencil for our fork until the homework was done, which is enormous
incentive.
Yeah, it sure was. And life was simple. It wasn't complicated. You know, it's one of those things where in 1960, when John Kennedy, a son of Boston, ran for president, we were Irish Catholic, and he was Irish Catholic, and that was good enough for us. We thought he was like us. We didn't know he was rich. but it was electrifying when he won, because people really did have a sense that one of us could never be president. And it really did transform our neighborhood, and certainly in the schools. We talked about it endlessly. And we had, in 1962, President Kennedy came to Buffalo for the Pulaski Day Parade, a big Polish celebration.
Yeah.
And it was right in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. So my life was very much intertwined with being Irish, being Catholic, John Kennedy being elected president, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the assassination of President Kennedy. And finally, we had a neighborhood watch system that was second to none. My parents, my relatives, my neighbors, my teachers, they were all in one big great conspiracy to prevent little Timmy from being mischievous.
To know whatever happened. New York Post calls it the Angela's Ashes of Buffalo, and Buffalo has loved it in return. Sports, no small part of that world. You write you were born on May 7th, 1950, and that every spring your dad's birthday present was a trip to see the Yankees play. Yankee Stadium was a little far from Buffalo, but Cleveland, not so far.
We'd pack up the green station wagon, my dad and three uncles up front, and I'd be in the back of the station wagon with the Coleman ice chest. I was the equivalent of a beer jockey, and it was a different time in the 50s. There were no highways, there were no seat belts, and people would drive along and guzzle beer
all the way to Cleveland.
Yeah, and I realize now, you know, mothers from against drunk driving really didn't appear until late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
And how much our thinking has changed about that, thank God, and how much my own has, particularly now that I have an 18-year-old son. But those days were magical for me. We'd drive to Cleveland and sit there for a doubleheader and drive home, one major league game a year. The anticipation of writing the envelope, asking for the schedule, and then sending a money order for the tickets. This is way before the internet or anything like it. The Yankees, particularly Yogi Berra, was my childhood hero. The Buffalo Bisons played baseball, a fellow by the name of Luke Easter, who could hit the ball about 500 feet plus. And of course, the Buffalo Bills. And my favorite was Cookie Gilchrist, who drove around Buffalo in a pink Cadillac and painted backwards on his front hood was, "Looky, looky, here comes Cookie," so you could see it in your rearview mirror.
And you would know And then there was a Jesuit school. And you write that the kind of education you got there remains important to the way you interact with the world, perhaps to the way you do your job Sunday mornings.
I encountered someone named Father John Sturm, who was the prefect of discipline. And he understood that there was a small group of us coming from the south side of the city who would probably remain very cliquish, but for his efforts to have us assimilated into the school population, where there were a lot of sons of doctors and lawyers and more privileged positions, if you would, in the culture and society of Buffalo, the south side being the more working class part. Mm-hmm. And that changed my life because I was really exposed to people of different walks of life and different pedigrees. I had an encounter with Father Sturm the second or third day at Canisius, and when he threw me against the lockers for some perceived indiscretion, and I said, "Father, don't you believe in mercy?" And he said, "Restored mercies for God, I deliver justice." And that was accountability. It's something I learned and stayed with me. And when I went home and complained to my dad, Big Russ, that this priest had put me against the locker and punished me, there was no appeal and no lawsuit filed by a parent against a teacher. It was, "You're grounded 2 weeks."
And if he thought you were wrong, you were wrong.
Yeah, yeah. If Father said you did wrong, you'd done wrong, period. There's this end of subject. And they really did reinforce each other. And I look back at that in an interesting way now, because I think it really did help me understand that you had to work hard and you had to be responsible for your behavior. And there were certain expectations and things you had to understand and adjust to and conform with sometimes. And it was a very important life lesson.
How do you see the values that you soaked up in that South Buffalo neighborhood, in that family, under your father's wing, playing out in the work you do today, Tim Russert?
As I look at our situation in Washington, I try to approach it from the perspective of who I am and where I came from. So when people are talking about tax cuts or Social Security or Iraq, I try very much to draw them out in a way that would make sense. It would be meaningful and understandable to people. It's just so easy to get caught up in a debate with language that is just so far beyond person who works hard all week and is tuning in on a Sunday morning to follow. And so it takes a lot of effort to go back and read all the transcripts and all the prior interviews that your guest has done, so that when they come on Meet the Press, you can say, "Senator, I know you've said X, Y, and Z, but let me ask it this way." And you kind of take away their canned answer so you can get them to reflect in an honest way as to what really has to happen. And I think if there's anything that's a so-called secret to the success of Meet the Press, it's exactly that. There's an expectation that you're going to have good, solid questions, firmly based in hard research and preparation, and you're going to do your best to try to get an honest answer.
Out of that Buffalo milieu comes Tim Russert years later, interviewing the highest and the mightiest in the land. You write about your first meeting with the current sitting president, George Bush, in Austin, in I think 99, when he was revving up his run for the presidency, and meeting there, talking about baseball, that sports line, you know, being a kind of common ground for you two guys again. And then later, in May of 2001, an extraordinary event at the White House that you were lucky enough to attend with your son, Luke, where the president had 62 Hall of Famers alive and kicking, 40 or so came to the White House, Yogi Berra, Hank Aaron, Bob Feller, Tom Seaver, Duke Snyder, Bob Gibson, Carly Ustremsky, and on and on. You and Luke there. I wish you'd read just a bit for us on page 122. I think you've got your book there, Tim, if you would. From the top down to A Boy and His Dreams, just to give a sense of how the president then took you under his wing and you and your son into the Oval Office.
As the White House event was ending, Stan Musial stood up on a chair and played Take Me Out to the Ball Game on his harmonica. We were about to leave when the president came over and said, "Luke, how you doing? Have you ever seen the Oval Office?" "No, sir." The president escorted us to his office, where Vice President Dick Cheney was waiting for him. "Come on in, Veep," the president said. "I want you to meet the famous Luke." Both men had heard me talk about him, and the president had met Luke during the campaign. "Let's take some pictures here," the president said, and while we waited for the photographer, he asked Luke what position he played on the St. Albans junior varsity team. "First base.
Really? That was my dad's position. And what's the name of your team? The Bulldogs. Wait a minute. That was my dad's team. What's going on here? Back in the car, I suggested to Luke that he write the president a thank you note. His letter went something like this. Dear Mr. President, thank you for introducing me to the Hall of Famers and for showing me the Oval Office. I think that if I really work hard, I'll have a chance for both. The next time I saw the president, I told him about my son's ambitious plans. His response was beautiful. Never get between a boy and his dreams.
President George W. Bush, in an off-camera interaction there with NBC's, the host of NBC's Meet the Press, Tim Russert. It's beautiful. It's heartwarming. What father wouldn't want to be in that situation with his son? Incredible, with all those baseball players, famed players, and the president and the vice president. But let me ask you this, Tim. Is it possible for you with your Buffalo values or anybody else to live in that kind of glorious intimacy with the president and the vice president and maintain the distance, the hard-hitting quality that Americans, I think, want in their journalists after the president has taken you into the Oval Office, you know, and given you that kind of access to your son?
Yeah, I would respectfully disagree with glorious intimacy. I've taken
40 baseball Hall of Famers in the Oval Office, president and vice president. That's a pretty good day.
Yeah, but it's not intimacy. I think that's a little strong, but it's your word, not mine.
Okay.
I've taken my son on the campaign trail since he's a little baby, with Reverend Jesse Jackson, with Michael Dukakis, with Al Gore, with whomever. I'm not a social animal. I don't go to very many parties, and so I don't have a problem in sitting down with people and asking tough questions. If there's a suggestion that somehow you're going to be co-opted because the president was nice to your son, that may happen with some people. I don't think it happened to me.
But it's a fair question, isn't it? I mean, you talk about Americans who sit back and they look at Washington, and most people can't imagine the circumstance you just described there. And people must think, by gosh, you know, as you put it, Tim, in terms I could describe, that's pretty seductive as everyday American.
It may be to some, but you go around the country, and I do a lot, and I go to city halls, and I see city hall reporters meeting with the mayor and talking to the mayor, and they're very much aware, or state capitals, people talking to the governor. There are two schools. You can try to cover Washington by the way Richard Rivera did, sitting up at the Hudson.
Right.
Or you can try to cover Washington by keeping your eyes and ears and antenna open and listening to everything. And so my job is simple. I learn as much as I can about my guest and take the other side. I do that each and every week to Democrats and Republicans. And I think the public is a very good judge as to whether it's effective. They have the ultimate decision maker. It's called a clicker. Mm-hmm. They can turn you off and stop watching you.
Mm-hmm.
So I do the best I can. I do what I think is right. I don't have favorites. I'm not a registered Democrat. I'm not a registered Republican. I just go out and report it as straight as I can.
Appearing on your show has come to be seen as a kind of test, especially for candidates. John Edwards was judged to have done a bad job on Meet the Press with Tim Russert and suffered for that. What do you think of that, of yourself, your show, your questioning as a key hurdle for public figures in American life?
Well, I'm not a very good judge. I don't quite know, who makes those judgments. I read the columnists, I guess, are probably the people who do it. I simply ask the questions and then let people give answers the best they can. Often there is a response to it from rival campaigns or political columnists or political commentators. But it's not new. John Kennedy called Meet the Press the 51st state way back then. In fact, I remember one time in 1992, I had an interview with Ross Perot, who was ahead of George Bush and Bill Clinton in the polls.
Early on, yeah.
May of 92. And he said he could balance the budget without breaking a sweat. And I kept asking for specifics, and he got a little agitated. And so the next day, I went on a shuttle flight from Washington to New York, and the flight attendant ran down the aisle and said, "That was an amazing interview with Ross Perot. What do you think of Mr. Perot?" And I said, "Ma'am, I really don't talk about my guests and their performance, but I'm endlessly curious as to what voters and viewers think. What did you think of Ross Perot? And she paused, and the flight attendant said, he strikes me as the kind of guy that would never return his tray table to the upright position. So I considered she was less than undecided.
Straight from the attendant's mouth.
So I think it's important that people treat the show seriously, and that they're going to come on. They know it's not going to be a forum or a vehicle where they can just simply parrot shibboleths or canned phrases, that they have to be reflective and think about their answers. I don't think you can make hard decisions as an elected official unless you're willing to answer tough questions. In fact, many people I've talked to who've worked in the White House, for both Democrats and Republicans, would privately say they welcomed press conferences because even though they were high risk politically, making a mistake or a faux pas, they could get decisions made about policy. Mr. President, you're going to be asked about Iraq and the number of troops. You're going to be asked about tax cuts.
So they had to clarify.
And they had to really focus. You know, nothing concentrate the mind like the prospect of hangings. And they had to really begin to focus as to what exactly they were going to say.
What kind of edge do you look for, or line of questioning? You very often come out with a central focus for your questioning in an interview. When you had Wesley Clark on, it was all about whether or not he would be willing to accept the position of vice president on a ticket. And you went at that again and again and again. How do you decide where you're going to train your fire, Tim Russert?
Well, I generally prepare for about a three-hour interview because you never know where the guest is going to lead you. And every show has its own course and energy and tempo, largely based on the guest answers. So, for example, this past weekend, you mentioned the Colin Powell famous palm tree incident.
By the Dead Sea.
Later in that program, I asked John McCain whether he would, in fact, accept a position as vice president on the Democratic ticket with John Kerry, and his answer was, could someone move the camera over to the palm tree,
give
please?
Us some palm trees here, right.
Right. But I knew, you know, that was a cute answer, but it wasn't a complete one, so I went back two or three times, and you try to pin the guest down the best you can, not to play gotcha, but to get specific responses, because these politicians are trained. I mean, they really have handlers, and they have practice sessions, and they really want to be able to go out and make a favorable impression without being specific and being tied to a particular answer or response that's going to come back to haunt them. So I prepare for 3 hours, and then sometimes you ask a question and you get a yes or no and you move on. Other times you find or feel that there's a bit of evasiveness going on, and you hone in and try to bring out the truth. And you never have enough time. I wish I had 5 hours with President Bush and 5 hours with John Kerry.
They're all good at the filibuster. Why the VP question again and again for Wesley Clark? Did you think that was the most important question, or he just didn't give you quite clear enough an answer so you wouldn't let him go until he did?
Yeah, I was just because in my reporting, I had found out that he was actually quite interested in becoming the vice president. And taking steps in my mind that to try to secure it if it came his way. And so I thought I was just trying to share that with the public and have him and find out from him exactly whether he was willing to acknowledge it.
We're talking tonight with the host of NBC's Meet the Press, Tim Russert. He's out with a new book about himself and his father, most of all, Big Russ and Me. It's called Father and Son, Lessons of Life. We'll be back in a moment with more of Tim Russert. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the host of NBC's Meet the Press, Tim Russert. He is often described as the king of the Sunday morning Washington talk world, even described as bigger than his guests in a town of some very big guests. He's out with a new book called Big Russ and Me, Father and Son, Lessons of Life, about the personality and, I guess, a legacy of values and worldview that he took away from his father, Tim Russert, who is still, Tim, tell me, I think I'm right, still a resident of Buffalo.
Yeah, Big Russ is 80 years old and going strong. He's struggling with prostate cancer a little bit, but we all will. And as his doctor told him, Big Russ, you will not die from prostate cancer. we're on to something else. But he is an extraordinary man in that, you know, the older I get, the smarter he gets, particularly when you have your own child, your own son. You realize all the times you rolled your eyes at your dad's advice or instructions, how true they were. The biggest challenge for me as a father is trying to pass on to my own son the values, the lessons that my dad taught me and tried to instill in me. And it, but 2004 is different than 1954 or 1964. And how do I teach my son that he's always, always loved but never, never entitled, I think is central to my mission as a father. The sense of entitlement is one that I never want my son to grasp onto.
And one that you did not find in the streets of Buffalo. You present that.
No, you did not.
you present that as a kind of working class idol. Your hometown paper, the Buffalo News, says, you know, this, maybe it's not even ironic, just maybe in fact there's a close connection. As the city declines, great books about the city's life and times begin to appear. Buffalo on hard times, as you describe, you know, in the sort of warm mist of childhood memory, how great it was, even when if it wasn't affluent or entitled.
Yeah, I read that. Buffalo, it's an interesting place, and its history is interesting. It was one time the eighth biggest city in the country, and it clearly has had some seismic shakes to it in terms of the economy, when Republic Steel and Bethlehem Steel and the Chevy and Ford stamping plants left. And it's now trying to redefine itself. There's a lot more smaller boutique businesses. The largest employer now is the State University of New York at Buffalo, which is extraordinary, a blue-collar city which now has a university as its primary or one of its largest employers. Mm. But nonetheless, there's still this feeling, this attitude, the city of good neighbors, this place that that loves itself and can't understand why others don't want to share in that same affection and emotion. Just to give you a sense of this, in my class at Canisius High School, Tom Fontana came out and wrote Homicide: Life on the Street. Tony Yurkovich did Miami Vice. And I do Meet the Press. And across the street, Narden Academy, our sister girls' school, Diane English did Murphy Brown.
And this just from your class?
It's incredible. The same street corner in Buffalo, New York. And I don't know what it is other than growing up in Buffalo, being aware, being alert, being sensitive to people and places around you, and a very good training and education. The biggest concern that I have is that many of the people in my class in high school have now left Buffalo. And how cities like it keep their people, the people who are trained and educated and can really give back. And it's a challenge not only in Buffalo, but all across the Midwest, particularly in a lot of other places.
From that same article in your hometown paper, the Buffalo News, Tim Russert style, we've got to put some quote up here on the screen, as you might. They go on to say that throughout your book, this telling of a life and a relationship with the father, they say all through it, candor runs smack up against a wall of Irish Catholic stoicism and a hugely ambitious man's, that would be you, deftness at manipulating information. You yourself, Tim, you know, write about coming early on to be educated in expectations and certain, you know, when the father says this is right, certain expectation of conforming. Is there also a sense in which Tim Russert's questioning and his view of the world is restrained by that Buffalo childhood, by that respect for authority, by that sense that you will conform to what father says?
Oh, I guess it depends on the ideology of the viewer.
Does it really? Isn't that too easy to fob it off on ideology here? I mean, there's psychology that goes beyond ideology.
No, I'm not fobbing it off. I mean, the person you're quoting, in terms of full disclosure, you know, has a clear political ideology.
I don't know him. Jeff Simon, the books editor at the Buffalo News.
Mm-hmm. There are some people, I've had people write me say that I should not interview George Bush because he's a war criminal. Well, you can accept that or reject it or find that that's a valid argument or not. I've had people saying you should reach over and, you know, wag your finger and choke him because mm-hmm. he's not giving you the true answer. Mm-hmm. When I have John Kerry on, Republicans will say, you know, why didn't you spend the whole show trying to stop him from dissembling about his comments about atrocities in Vietnam from 1971?
And nothing else. That would be fine.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody has an agenda. You hear about red states and blue states. The fact is the country is 45-45, Bush, Kerry, and 10% undecided. And when you're interviewing a guest, the 45% for the other guy are looking at it in a way that from a political lens. Now, some are harder than others. I mean, most people have a pretty good sense what the role of a journalist is, and that's trying to elicit information. And you can use several different tactics. You can browbeat people. You can be abusive. You can be impolite. Mm-hmm. You can continue. I think if you reach over and try to insult somebody, you're suddenly making that person very sympathetic. And I don't want to make my guests sympathetic.
You mean that is to the viewers, saying that poor guy's being beaten up by Tim Russert, so I'm on the interviewee's side.
Well, I think almost immediately. And so I don't want to do anything which would anyway cause the viewer to make a judgment about the person that wouldn't be accurate. Why make the guest sympathetic? And when you ask a question and the guest dodges it, and you come back and say, Senator, that's an interesting answer, but it's not responsive to my question, so let me ask my question again. The viewers get it immediately. They know who spins. They know who bobs and weaves. They know who answers.
But as everybody has an agenda, of course, journalists try not to. Still, it's hard to shed entirely. When you reach such a peak of influence as you have now, Tim, do you ask yourself, over a beer after work, am I pressing widely, deeply, hard enough? I mean, you're popular because you're seen as being a better, deeper questioner than the average on Sunday morning. But is it good enough? Given all the challenges the country faces right now, what a radical time of change we're in. Does Tim Russert press hard enough, deep enough?
Well, I try to press both sides as hard and deep as I can. Some liberal Democrats would prefer Michael Moore to be on Sunday mornings. Some Republicans would prefer William F. Buckley. But my job is not to be a partisan Democrat or Republican. My job is to question people the best I can. I don't have an agenda. And if there's a suggestion, I think sometimes that people say, well, listen, you know the war is wrong. Therefore, you have an obligation to pin George W. Bush down and force him to say, yes, yes, you're right. My job is to find out what the president's thinking is and why he said that there were weapons of mass destruction, based on what, and whether it was a war of choice or necessity. And so, too, with John Kerry. In October of 2002, why he voted to authorize the president to go to war, and why some months later he voted against the $87 billion to, in effect, fund the war. I try to do that in an even-handed way. It's never going to satisfy some people on the hard right or some people on the hard left. And for that, I make no apologies. But what I do know is that, by and large, most people are left of center, right of center, but they are open-minded and objective and really do appreciate probing questions that's not insulting.
What does the old man, what does Big Russ have to say about the balance that son Tim Russert strikes?
Well, he gave me pretty good advice about the recent interview I had with President Bush and John Kerry. But he said, I've signed on with NBC through 2012. So he said, you're going to be at NBC longer than they're going to be there, so you feel comfortable. But the Oval Office is going to be there longer than you are, so be respectful. And I think that's pretty good advice. I try to be respectful of everybody. And that's of the high-up power brokers I interview or people I meet in my everyday life. I just think that is an important part of being a human being. When I was a little boy, I tried to get Joe Pepitone's autograph, a New York Yankee who came to Buffalo, and he stiffed us, as he would say. And my dad said, always remember that. It takes just as much time to be nice to a person as it does to be a jerk. And I took that to heart.
Tim Russert, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Tim Russert, host of NBC's Meet the Press, author of the new book, Big Russ and Me, Father and Son, Lessons of Life. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. A day after members of the 9/11 Commission criticized New York City's police and fire departments for their response on September 11, 2001, former Mayor Rudolph Giuliani today jumped to the defense of New York's fire and police forces. In the second day of public testimony, less than 2 miles from where the World Trade Towers once stood, Giuliani told the commission that mistakes were made, but said maybe 9,000 people more than anyone could rightfully expect were evacuated to safety thanks to the efforts of rescue workers. The mayor, whose testimony was interrupted by heckling family members of those who died, added that the commission should be focusing on preventing another terrorist attack rather than assigning blame. Here is an excerpt from Giuliani's testimony.
We're all hurt. We're all damaged. We're all very, very angry. And we're all feeling the loss of heroes that we love. There's probably no one in this city, and there are many in this country, that have been personally touched, sometimes many-fold, by the losses on September 11, 2001. But we have to channel our anger toward doing all that we can to prevent and ameliorate any further attack, because by all predictions, further attacks are going to come. Our enemy is not each other, but the terrorists who attacked us, murdered our loved ones, and continue to offer a threat to our security, safety, and survival. We had great unity after September 11, 2001. I've never seen this country more united. I remember driving up West Street with President Bush and Governor Pataki and the three gentlemen you questioned yesterday, Commissioner Shearer, Commissioner Carrick, and Commissioner Von Essen, all of whom had just a few days earlier almost lost their own lives trying to protect the people of the city, and some of whom were suffering from the loss of not just a friend or friends, but hundreds of them. And our spirits were low, and we were very emotional. And as we drove up West Street was lined with 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 people holding American flags, waving to the president, waving to us, telling the president they loved him and they were together as New Yorkers. I did note for the president that none of the people had voted for him. Or me. Or Governor Pataki. But that's the point. They were all united as Americans because we understood who our enemy was. Our enemy is not each other. Catastrophic emergencies and attacks have acts of great heroism attached to them. They have acts of ingenious creativity attached to them. And they have mistakes that happen. Hopefully this commission will assess that correctly with compassion and with understanding. And then the next one will be done a little bit better. But the next one, unfortunately, is probably going to be a mix of exactly those same things. Acts of great heroism, many, many creative and brilliant things done, and some terrible mistakes that were made. Because when human beings are put under this condition, that's what happens. So our anger should clearly be directed, and the blame should clearly be directed at one source and one source alone, the terrorists who killed our loved ones. For each other, there really should be compassion, understanding, and support, because we're all suffering.
Former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani testifying today before the 9/11 Commission in New York. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jupp, Eileen Amata, Jane Manners, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skoke, with help from Yotam Barkai, Michael Garth, and Darren Manoogian. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.